from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Cognitive decline is reversible. That's according to neurologist Dale Bresidan, who says much can be done through a new protocol, which includes diet changes, exercise, and the addition of some supplements and pharmaceuticals. Dr. Bresidan joins us to talk about recent medical advances in Alzheimer's disease and his book, The End of Alzheimer's. Join us next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Despite over $1 billion spent on research in the past decade, Alzheimer's disease has no known cure. But that may soon change, according to neurologist Dale Bredesen, and recent evidence suggests that a broad-based therapeutic approach, including diet, brain stimulation, and pharmaceuticals, may help halt or even reverse progression of the disease. In this hour, we're going to discuss Dale Bredesen's research and his book, The End of Alzheimer's, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, I'm having you back here because last time I had you here, you were talking about coming off of decades of research and some reversal of cognitive decline and some pretty impressive results, but small results, and you still want to do a bigger clinical trial, need to do a bigger clinical trial.
That's absolutely right, Michael. So we have over 1,000 people on this protocol now, and as we've published in peer-reviewed journals, we've had unprecedented improvements in some of these people. However, as you say, we need a larger clinical trial, and we are actually doing just that with Providence Hospital, and there will be another one with Cleveland Clinic as well.
Yeah, I read about the Cleveland Clinic. I'm from Cleveland. That's exciting, and it's an exciting place to work with. Some of these results are pretty dramatic, but most of them are early Alzheimer's, right?
Well, no question, the earlier the better. We've had people who improve who are at very late stage, but as you say, the earlier the better. And by the way, we just had someone whose driver's license was returned, and she was pronounced to no longer have Alzheimer's by an outside physician. So we're excited about results like that.
And let's talk about the fact that it's not a single disease. I mean, this is in many people's minds. If you're going to get a cure, you get a cure for Alzheimer's because this is one monolithic disease. We're talking about your metaphor has always been like 36 holes in your roof or something along those lines.
Exactly. And so, you know, this is all about the fact that 100 years ago, the medicine we practiced focused on simple diseases, pneumococcal pneumonia, tuberculosis, things like that. And in fact, now we are almost all dying of complex chronic illnesses. And we call it Alzheimer's, but what does that mean? That doesn't tell you anything about what actually causes it. So you have to look at much larger data sets. You have to look at the many contributors. And we initially, as you said, identified 36 different contributors. They also tell you that there are subtypes, as you mentioned.
And there really is no new Alzheimer's drug. There hasn't been anything new since about 2003.
That's correct, yes. The last one was Namenda, so it's been a while.
But the fact of the matter is that you're looking at this from metabolic imbalance to a great extent, aren't you?
So we're looking from the opposite end, actually. And so we've spent 30 years now in the lab looking at what actually drives the process. I mean, just as, you know, in the 1600s, you'd say you died from fever, we now say, you know, you die from Alzheimer's. Well, you shouldn't end that with a period. You should say Alzheimer's due to what? And we identified many different contributors, and we identified a fundamental signaling cascade that is out of balance in Alzheimer's disease. And there are different contributors. My wife, as you know, Aida, is a family practitioner who and integrative physician who told me 30 years ago, you know, whatever you guys find in the lab, it's going to have something to do with basic processes like diet and exercise and sleep and stress and things like this and metabolism. And of course, at the time, I was very reductionistic, and I should have listened to her all those years ago because she was absolutely telling us that, you know, it was on the right track.
Talking with Dale Bredesen, by the way, he's director of the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA, professor, and also with the Buck Institute for Research in Aging in Marin, and author of a book called The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. want to talk about Alzheimer's survivors now, don't we? I mean, that's really what you're aiming for here. But you just alluded to the fact that lifestyle, I always hesitate when I use that word. Susan Sontag said, if you have a lifestyle, mm-hmm. doesn't mean you have a life. And you know, yeah. it plays an important role in your whole protocol. And a lot of things make sense to, let's say, the non-skeptical mind. Sleep quality and stress and hormone levels, all that. But when you start talking about things like, micronutrients or vitamins, skeptical hackles go up and concern goes up. I mean, this has been pretty much what you've encountered, hasn't it? Especially when you're talking about even things like the kind of toothbrush you use and so forth.
Yeah, so no surprise there's been skepticism. But let me throw it back the opposite direction here. Do you really believe that you're going to take a complex chronic signaling pathway in your brain that has dozens and dozens and dozens of inputs, and that's what this is, and that you're going to take one drug that has one mechanism? This is, again, like trying to close 36 holes in your roof with one patch on one hole. It simply does not make any scientific sense. So it's not about lifestyle, it's about biochemistry. And so for the first time, we can look at all the biochemical parameters that actually contribute to this. And then, as you say, we want to optimize all of these biochemical parameters. Now, there's certainly absolutely a role for drugs. Drugs are a very, very good way to close one hole at a time. But you want to test these drugs on the background of an overall optimized and personalized program. So we have a computer-based algorithm that will tell you what subtypes are contributing and tell you what an optimal initial program will be. And then, of course, you work with your physician to optimize that.
So when you start talking about things like processed food or gluten, you know, avoiding things like that, or This is the sort of thing that people immediately almost have a knee-jerk reaction and say, that's loopy stuff. You know, that's not biochemistry.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a neuroscientist, if you had told me 10 or 15 years ago that I would be telling people that meditation is actually helpful.
Or yoga.
And that they shouldn't eat food with gluten in it and things like that, I would have laughed. The surprise is these things actually do make a difference in your brain chemistry. And, of course, there are many, many papers now on meditation and, for example, TM, where, you know, people see increase in telomere length. So, you know, there are things that are real measurable changes that you get with these various things. And so, again, why would you try to do one piece when you've got something that's a complex change? It's a little bit like saying, you know, if you want to change your company, are you just going to change one janitor? No, you're going to change linchpins throughout the company. And that's exactly what we're doing here with brain disease.
Well, you mentioned the computer algorithm. Talk about cognoscopy. This is a new concept for many people.
So, you know, everybody knows that when you turn 50, you should have a colonoscopy. And it's a good thing to do. Make sure that you don't get colorectal cancer or catch it early. So we recommend that everybody over 45 years of age should consider a cognoscopy. And Maria Shriver told me, don't ever use that term. It's a horrible term. Yes, it's not a beautiful term. But it actually is something that people understand easily, and it's relatively simple to do. It's some blood tests that you can get. Everybody should know their fasting insulin. Everybody should know their hsCRP, just as you know your cholesterol. Everybody should know their copper-zinc ratio, and everybody should know their TGF-beta-1, as an example. These are all things that can tell us whether we're at risk. And here's the reality, Michael. Dementia should be a rare condition. Right now, it is the third leading cause of death in the United States. It is the number one cause of death in the UK. It has now advanced beyond the deaths induced by cancer and by cardiovascular disease.
I just have to ask you as a footnote, where does the former First Lady of California fit into this picture?
Well, she is a very important activist in this area. She's done a tremendous amount of work in this area for 15 to 20 years. Of course, as you know, unfortunately, her family, as so many of our families have been affected by this illness, has been affected by it. And so she's extremely knowledgeable and just actually had a wonderful event at Hearst Tower in New York City just recently. So she has really brought awareness of this illness and has pointed out, by the way, that about 65% of the patients are female and about 60% of the caregivers. So this is, as she says, a woman-centric disease.
Talking to Dale Bredesen again, he's the author of The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. I have a friend, Ken Dykewald, who's a gerontologist who just got the big X Prize, and he's got a group that's actually working to end Alzheimer's. Is there a parallel here with your work and theirs?
Oh, absolutely. And so initially, of course, the X Prize, I was at one of the meetings, the early Visioneers meeting, as they call it, back in 2013. And of course, we went around the room and discussed what would a prize like this look at for Alzheimer's. And of course, the X Prize has prided itself on being ahead of the game and looking at very visionary goals. And of course, my argument at the time was the prize should be given to the person or a group that for the first time actually shows improvement rather than just slowing decline. And interestingly, the response around the room was, that's impossible. So we've seen it now in hundreds of patients. So it's not impossible. It's a question of how long this will last. We have people that are now, 5.5 years out on the program and doing extremely well with continued improvement. But I think the XPRIZE will be an important support for looking at this. Now, as you probably know, the XPRIZE has decided to look at biomarkers that are actionable, which I think is certainly a good idea. But in the long run, we all want the same thing, which is to make it so that you have survivors, people who actually improve with Alzheimer's disease.
Since you mentioned, we brought up the XPRIZE. I had the privilege 1 year of being co-host of the XPRIZES with Robin Williams, who many people feel committed suicide because of Parkinson's, but he actually had Lewy body disease now. It's been pretty much corroborated. And that fits into your picture, too. I mean, that's a terrible disease. It's a disease that, with many other diseases like dementia, is often lumped together, different kinds of dementia, with Alzheimer's. But they're all different in different ways, aren't they?
Absolutely. So as you know, Michael, we described three different major subtypes. What we found is that when you look at what changes an imbalance in the brain of Alzheimer's, it's actually somewhat analogous to looking at osteoporosis. When you have osteoporosis, your osteoblasts that are making the bone and your osteoclasts that are picking up the bone are out of balance for years. So you've actually pulled away the bone. You've actually stripped away the bone more than you've placed it down. And the same thing happens in Alzheimer's. There is synaptoblastic signaling making the synapses. And there's a whole set of things that are synaptoclastic signaling, pulling back. And so you have this beautiful balance for years. Now, if you look at the things that actually pull back, that give you too much synaptoclastic signaling for the amount of synaptoblastic, they fall into a couple of groups. Chronic inflammation. So if you've got ongoing pathogens and things like that, you're actually making the amyloid of Alzheimer's to kill the pathogen. So it's literally a protective response in your brain. Secondly, loss of trophic support. If you don't have enough nerve growth factor or vitamin D or brain-derived, any of those things, then in fact you have type 2 Alzheimer's disease. And then the third thing is toxins. And that includes things like mercury and things like biotoxins. Surprisingly, molds produce toxins that in some people lead to Alzheimer's disease. We were surprised to see all of these things. Now, what we found is what Robin Williams has, as you alluded to, Lewy body disease is actually closely related to type 3 Alzheimer's disease. It is toxin-related, as is Parkinson's. And so these are all essentially cousins of each other.
They're all diseases of toxicity.
They are, exactly right.
And you've got the protocol now that can actually detoxify?
So you have to look. So we've seen people coming now with toxins due to being in the World Trade Center cloud. Here's the surprise. 12.8% of the people who were in the World Trade Center cloud now have cognitive decline. It is shocking. And the people who wrote the paper actually said they were surprised to see how many of the first responders are now developing dementia. People who have, who are in, for example, places that have chronic burning of paraffin candles liberates toxins, and this can give you type 3 Alzheimer's disease. Air pollution, as you heard about just recently from USC, Dr. Tuck Finch down at USC and his colleagues showed that, in fact, people who are exposed to air pollution have an increased risk for Alzheimer's. So, yes, all of these things can lead to that response in your brain that we call Alzheimer's disease.
And what about the standard ways of going about looking for Alzheimer's, especially early Alzheimer's? I mean, people think, check my sodium, check my potassium, things of that sort.
This is a really good point. So the problem problem is that we are still looking at very, very tiny data sets. Of course, a human being, and the human brain especially, is incredibly complex. But classically, we as physicians have looked at very, very tiny data sets, things, as you said, like sodium and potassium. And in fact, we need to be looking at much larger data sets. When you do that, you can actually see the things that are driving the risk.
I want to ask you also about recently I did an event at UC Berkeley having focus on CRISPR and all this new gene editing and everything. There's a lot of, well, hope attached to that, and hope attached to Alzheimer's to cure too?
Well, if you have a genetic predisposition, but of course many people don't have the genetic form of Alzheimer's disease. So the actual, for example, a mutation in APP is a rare cause of Alzheimer's. Less than 1% of people who have Alzheimer's have it due to a mutation in APP. So correcting that with CRISPR would be a rare help. In general, what this is actually telling us is that this is due to the way you're living, the things you're exposed to, your metabolism, as you said, and things like that.
But we're at a point now as far as genetic predicting. We're on the horizon of that pretty much, aren't we, with Genome Project and all?
Absolutely. But again, so the genome, is, as they often say, is, you know, the genome is just the trigger, and then your lifestyle is pulling the trigger. So you actually may have a risk, but that does not mean you can get it. For example, people who have APOE4, and this is the most common genetic risk factor, and if you have zero copies of APOE4, you have about a 9% risk through your lifetime. If you have a single copy of APOE4, you have about a 30% risk through your lifetime. And if you have two copies of APOE4, you are over 50% and closing in on 90% risk. So very important, there are 75 million Americans living with a single copy of APOE4, and there are 7 million Americans living with two copies. So very important, if you have this, find out, get on a prevention program early.
How good are we, though, at diagnosing overall Alzheimer's, especially in those early phases where you've had success?
So great point. And in fact, if you do the testing, we're very good at it. So if you have a PET scan, for example, that's very good at telling you whether you have Alzheimer's disease, even in the earliest phases. And as you alluded to, you actually can essentially see it coming. And in fact, you have the pathophysiology that leads to Alzheimer's for about 20 years before the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Again, which is why we recommend everybody over 45 get your cognoscopy, see where you stand, because dementia should be a rare problem.
We're talking with Dale Bredesen. He is director of the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA and a professor there. Was for a number of years head of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Marin and author of The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. I know there are many of you who have questions for Dr. Bredesen, and if you do or if you'd like to join us, there are a number of ways you can do that. I'll give you a toll-free number, and you can call us, 866-733-6786. We'll try to get you on, as many of you as we can. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. Also, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, but we do welcome your involvement. And, you know, reading your book, I was fascinated to understand that, I mean, you've got your own patient zero in all this.
Absolutely. And by the way, I just talked to patient zero a couple of days ago. She's 5.5 years out now. She's 73 years old. Traveling the world, doing extremely well. And as I mentioned in the book, she's gone off the program 4 different times for various reasons, ran out of some of the things or was traveling.
Forgive me, we should mention the notion of patient zero, though, because it goes back to AIDS research.
Absolutely. So as you recall, back in AIDS research, there was a patient identified as, quote, patient zero, although, of course, it turned out that patient zero wasn't really patient zero. It was probably a couple decades after patient zero. But nonetheless, the idea of a very first patient, I did take that patient zero from the AIDS work back in the 80s. And patient zero for this treatment is doing extremely well.
I'm reading from your book here. Let me say this as clearly as I can. Alzheimer's disease can be prevented and in many cases is associated. Cognitive decline can be reversed. I mean, this, you know, this is like hosannas to many people because they thought, if I have it, it's an affliction. I should think about it, you know, Harry Carey or Hemlock or whatever. And, I mean, it's in many ways, as I think you point out in your book, or you intimate, worse than fatal diseases because often you know what you're dealing with and you still have your memory intact, regardless of the pain and all the rest of it. But with Alzheimer's, you're losing perhaps the most sacred thing you have, which is your memory.
That's exactly right. And as you know, Michael, it is now losing your cognition is now the number one fear as we age. It's exceeded cancer and other fears in the past. So it is a big concern for so many of us. And of course, so common. If you look at what percentage of people actually develop this during their lifetime, overall, it's about 15%. So even though we're always told that about 5.3 million Americans have Alzheimer's, of course, many of us are too young to know about that yet. So the question is, how many of the currently about 320 million living Americans will develop this disease during their lifetime? And the answer is about 45 million of us. So this is a huge issue. And this is exactly why we want to reduce the global burden of dementia.
How often, you're talking about early stages of Alzheimer's being the most, efficacious for the work that you're doing, but how often do we see people getting early onset? I mean, you know, I know somebody who got Alzheimer's early 50s, for example, or late 40s in another case.
Absolutely. And this has actually been surprising. When I was training at UCSF years ago, we did not see people in their 40s and 50s coming in with Alzheimer's disease. We're actually seeing many people now who are in their late 40s, early to mid 50s, who are developing Alzheimer's disease. And what is interesting is that most of those people turn out to be type 3. These are people who have been exposed to toxins. And it looks like one of the possibilities here is that you sequester some of these things, whether you're talking about mercury or some of the mycotoxins or some of the organic pollutants, you sequester these in your bone. And that protects you for a time. When you get to the point that you're approaching menopause, for example, or andropause, if you're a male, then what happens is you start releasing some of these things from your bone.
It's all pretty frightening stuff. But now that you've made some headway with your protocol and have gotten a good deal of attention and are on the New York Times bestseller list, you're going against some real foes here. I mean, there are a lot of obviously closed-minded people, but also some pretty powerful corporations.
Yeah. So, again, we're suggesting that drug companies should continue to test the drugs, but should do it on the backbone of a personalized program. But you're right, and I mentioned in the book that, we've got a lot of, not surprisingly, we've had a lot of pushback. And I always tell people, come and meet some of the patients. Come and talk to them. Come and look at their records. Come and look at what's actually changed here. We have hundreds of people now who can show improvements. So you're right, there's going to be pushback, not surprisingly. When I trained as a fellow, the laboratory I was in had a tremendous amount of pushback. In fact, they actually put the lab on the cover of a magazine to make fun of it. But in fact, what we were doing turned out to be correct. So you got to go against that sometimes.
You also got the best kind of flattery because you got a lot of imitators here and faux operators using the kind of protocol and trying to use it, then raises a question. A number of listeners want to know, here in the Bay Area, are cognoscopies available at Stanford or elsewhere?
So we've now trained over 600 physicians from 7 different countries and all over the United States in this protocol. And we actually have another 250 that will be trained in Miami next week. So we will have 2,000 trained by the end of next year. This is not being done at Stanford yet, but there are more and more who've learned this.
Are you listening, Stanford Medical School? We'll return with your phone calls. Dale Bredesen's our guest. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Dale Bredesen. Dr. Dale Bredesen directs the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA, where he's a professor and for a number of years was head of the Buck Institute here in the Bay Area for research on aging in Marin. He's also the author of a book that's out. It's called The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. Let's go right to your calls, and let's begin with Tom. Tom, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I would like to ask the professor, what he's talking about sounds a lot like preventative maintenance in healthcare, and I'm a lifelong Kaiser member and a recent member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease. And you know, Kaiser invented as the mother and the father of preventative maintenance. How much do you think his cognoscopy could be a trendsetter for Kaiser? And what kind of tests should be included? What nutritional components? And should gut biome and respiratory olfactory biome be part of the equation? Because I'm thinking, what have I polluted my body with in the past 10 years? You know, I read the label on the psyllium powder imported from India, and it's supposed to have metal chemical contaminants. So it's a fascinating topic, and I think it should be, the word should be spread.
Well, Tom, you've raised some important questions. Dale Bredesen?
Yeah, great point, Tom. And in fact, Kaiser has an annual meeting of the Innovators Group, and I will be the keynote speaker there in December this year to talk about exactly what you raised. I couldn't agree with you more. Kaiser cares for about 11 million people nationwide, and actually Kaiser could have a huge impact on the national burden of dementia. Now, this is beyond prevention, though. You mentioned prevention. Yes, absolutely important. And prevention is the most important way to go here. But what we're describing in the book includes reversal. And we don't say this is a cure. It's not. What it is, it's reversal of cognitive decline and stabilization. So people can, we've had people come back to normal and 5.5 years in doing very well. But there's an important distinction there. So, yes, I agree with you. This sort of program should be done broadly. And my hope is that, in fact, Kaiser and other large healthcare providers will adopt, and all of us will adopt, this exact sort of program. And as you said, you do want to know where you stand with respect to toxins. You want to know whether you've got mercury sticking in your bones. Is it in your brain? What levels? Do you need to address this now? Have you been exposed to mycotoxins? What is your home ERMI score? All of these things are critical, and these are all listed and discussed in the book.
And you can find out. You get a full rendering of whatever metals you have or whatever toxins you have. Here's David, though, who wants to know, by reversing the disease, does one actually retrieve memories ostensibly lost?
Yeah, this is a very good question. The answer is, at least sometimes, yes. So we have a woman, for example, and I describe her in the book, a wonderful woman who lives in New York and who actually went to a major university and was told that she was in early stages and did her, showed that she had, by neuropsychological testing, quantitated her decline. One of the things that she did, she had spoken both Chinese and Russian. She lost those. She regained her Chinese and Russian on the program. She's actually now been on for a couple of years and doing very well. She then went back to the same university where they retested her and showed her improvement. So at least in some cases, can we guarantee, we don't know. We don't know what things you will and will not regain, but we certainly have seen the regaining of things. Another person, for example, lost the ability to add columns of numbers rapidly in his head, and he got that back on the program.
And here's Cassidy. Cassidy, you're on. Morning.
Hi there. I had a question for you. I currently work as a welder. I weld aluminum pretty much all day, and I'm curious about, besides taking respiratory preventative maintenance on there, if there's anything else I can do to stop any other metals entering my bloodstream.
Tremendous amount you can do, actually, and it's a very good question. As you know, many years ago, it was suggested that aluminum was an important cause of Alzheimer's disease, and then, of course, many studies thereafter suggested that may not be the case. Now, recently, interestingly, Dr. Joseph Pizzorno, who's a toxicologist and ND up in Seattle, has done some very interesting epidemiology studies and looking at, what are the things that are associated? And, of course, again, association doesn't necessarily mean cause, but there is an association in his studies between a number of metals, including aluminum, and Alzheimer's disease. So first of all, you can find out where you stand, and there's easy ways to do this. As an example, Quicksilver does an, quote, all metals test and looks at things like aluminum and mercury and copper and zinc and so forth and so on. See where you actually stand. The second thing that you can do is, yes, there are numerous things from things that bind metals like chlorella to doing things that will decrease absorption through the gut, depending, again, on what metal, to detox. Do you know your glutathione level? That's a good thing to know, actually, for everybody, because this is a detoxicant that we all make endogenously. And you can support your body's own production of glutathione, which is a good idea. Again, sauna, something I would have laughed at 10 years ago, turns out to be a great way to get rid of various toxins. And by the way, if you've got multiple toxins, as so many of us do, just from our general exposure, that will decrease your ability to get rid of specific toxins like your aluminum, etc., because you will now drive your glutathione to lower levels. So yes, there's a tremendous amount you can do, and we go through some of these things in the book. And first of all, though, get checked out and see where your metals stand.
Good luck to you, Cassidy, and we thank you for the call. We go right on to another caller, and that's Teresa. Teresa, you're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for the work you do. I was recently looking at EMF Safety Network website, and I saw an interview between Dr. Mercola and a Dr. Paul, P-A-L-L. And Dr. Paul talks about the unacknowledged toxins in our environment, the radiation from wireless, and how it has a direct link to Alzheimer's as well as heart disease, because the electric portion or component in our bodies are really badly affected by the radiation, and I'd like to know if your guest has looked into that.
It's a great point, and actually I just talked to Joseph Mercola recently and others about this sort of thing. So there's no question that chemotoxins, things like mercury, can be contributors to cognitive decline. There's no question that biotoxins, things like mycotoxins, can be contributors to cognitive decline. We do not yet know whether physical toxins, things like EMFs, as you alluded to, can be a problem. Certainly trauma, no question. It predisposes you to cognitive decline. But as far as the more subtle trauma from electromagnetic fields, we don't have a lot of data. It's a great question. And, you know, we need more data in this area. But certainly, for sleeping, for example, it's good to minimize exposure to these sorts of fields.
Let me thank the caller. And here's a comment from Anne, who says, please correct the misinformation put up by your guest. Everybody does not know that we need a colonoscopy at age 50. I am a family doctor. We should start cancer screening at age 50. That does not mean that everybody needs a colonoscopy.
I would say that many people would disagree with that. Most people suggest that we do get a colonoscopy at age 50. And I guess I would love to hear from the doctor, what situations does she suggest that you not get a colonoscopy at age 50? Now, yes, there are new things like so-called Cologuard, where you can actually get a test that it substitutes for a colonoscopy. But I would say...
You can get a sigmoidoscopy too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's Richard, who wants to know, how does the rate of Alzheimer's differ in different countries compared to the United States?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. This has not been easy to determine because of the fact that in other countries, of course, there's the stigma, which there is in the U.S. as well. And so people sometimes, when you start having difficulty with cognition, you're stuck in the back room and ignored. And so you may not have the reporting that you necessarily need to get this. However, the suggestion has been that there is a decrease in some countries, such as India, and that's the one that's raised repeatedly. The suggestion has been that there's some association with the use of curcumin because it has a wonderful anti-inflammatory effect, and by the way, also binds the amyloid that we associate with Alzheimer's disease. So there is some difference, and in general, in third world countries, there is a decrease compared to people who are eating the standard American diet and living the standard American life.
Here's Marie-Louise from Palo Alto. And Marie-Louise, you've been calling this program ever since I've been here, as I recall. Haven't heard from you in a few years, but you're on with Dale Bredesen. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for this program. Yes, I used to call a lot. I missed the first 15 minutes of this program, and my question is, my father and my grandfather both suffered from Alzheimer's, but as I'm saying this, I also realized that my grandfather's sisters did too, to an extent. However, I've been wondering if Alzheimer's, if there could be a link between severe head injury.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. So first of all, as you mentioned, you have this in your family. Anyone who has a first-degree relative has a clear increase in likelihood of developing Alzheimer's. So again, very, very important to get a cognoscopy.
Excuse me, Dale, how do you determine, though, you know, my father had dementia. To this day, I don't know if it was Alzheimer's or just old-age dementia. I mean, there's so many varieties of this.
It's a very good point. There are many things. And of course, Alzheimer's is the most common thing. So if there was dementia, the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's. But as you mentioned earlier, things like Lewy body disease, frontotemporal dementia, vascular dementia, PSP, CBD, on and on. There
are
other
causes. More varieties, really.
Dozens. Yeah, certainly dozens and dozens of things that can cause dementia. So, for Marie-Louise, thank you for calling. And absolutely, it would be good to check this out and see, are you at risk?
And we thank Marie-Louise for the call. I'm going to go to more calls in a moment. But Elizabeth writes, my personal experience with Alzheimer's people has taught me that what you are saying is possible. My problem is that the response of physicians, medical and social work staff, not to mention others, is so vehemently negative that I cannot have a discussion about it with them. How can the fear of it be overcome to have a real conversation?
This is a really good point. And as I mentioned in the book, we had a very interesting email from a couple in Canada that went took the paper that we had first published on this into their doctor. And the doctor said, doctors don't read and doctors don't do nutrition. And of course, nutrition is an important thing for all of us for complex chronic illnesses. So you're right. This represents and this is part of a bigger revolution in medicine. Again, 20th century medicine was about what it is. Is it measles? Is it a broken leg? And we're going to give one drug and make it better. Great for TB, pretty good for TB, very good for pneumococcal pneumonia. 21st century medicine is about why. What are all the contributors to your complex chronic illness? Whether it is type 2 diabetes or whether it is Lewy body disease, and you need to look at these. It's a different way to think about medicine. And of course, integrative medicine is gaining popularity for that very reason, because it has results that you're not seeing with a single prescription.
It all evolved really from what used to be called holistic medicine. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here. I remember the day when that kind of came into the lexicon. Not so much in wide usage. Now, here's Jerry, who asked a real practical question. How much do any of these programs cost?
Yeah, great question. Well, certainly the first thing to know is what does it cost to be in a nursing home for a year? And it costs anywhere from $90,000 to $200,000 in that range. So these things cost less than 1% of what it costs to be in a nursing home for a year. So the point here is that you want to catch things, as you said earlier, want to catch things early. Depending on what doctor you go to for an evaluation, it may cost several $100 or it may cost a few $1,000s. By the way, my daughter just had a number of these tests recently, and I just got the bill yesterday. It was $20 because the rest, in fact, was reimbursed. So, in fact, a lot of these tests can be reimbursed. They aren't always. It depends on your health plan. Then once you start on an optimized program, it may cost you something like $75, $85, or $90 a month for various things. It depends on what you need. You can do a lot of this with diet, exercise, sleep, stress, and some brain training. And you can do all of those things very inexpensively.
Yeah, the brain exercises are kind of interesting. That's another thing that kind of gets skeptics' eyebrows up a lot of times. What are you talking about there in your protocol? Yeah.
So, and we always refer to Professor Mike Mersnick, who won the Kavli Prize this year and was really the world leader in neuroplasticity. He is the father of brain training. And as you said, brain training has had a little bit of a black eye because people would argue that some companies have oversold it. But in fact,
well, there's some charlatans out there, too.
Absolutely, as there are in everything. But there are several, quote, summaries of the book out there that are all fake. So the fact of the matter is that his work has been published in over 130 papers, so it's very supported. So what BrainHQ is doing is very legitimate. Whether these other imitators are as legitimate, I can't say. Secondly, you want to look at doing it with a background. Again, if you're going to lift weights, you want to do it with the right nutrition. So if you're going to do brain training, you want to make sure, and there are tremendous things you can do. For example, driving yourself into mild ketosis actually enhances brain function. Most of us are operating on a high carbohydrate diet, but in fact, your brain does better on a high fat, very low carbohydrate diet.
There's one point in your book where you say the only way to judge these things is efficacy. Does it improve? And, you know, does cognition improve? That's really the gold standard. That's the touchstone.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the proof is in the pudding. Okay. Proof is in the eating of the pudding. So, okay, you want to look. And so we encourage people and we look before and after at things like MoCA scores or MMSE or their various online tools you can use or standard neuropsychological testing. If you can make people better, that is the important thing. And in fact, we see it again and again and again. The other thing I would say, though, is also function. So, for example, we had one woman recently who had a MoCA score of zero. So this is advanced. She couldn't dress herself. She couldn't speak. She really could not do much of anything. She has improved and now interacts with her husband, speaks all the time, dresses herself, rides her bicycle again. Now, she's not back to normal, but she's certainly improved in her functioning.
We're talking with neurologist and professor Dale Bredesen, and his new book is The End of Alzheimer's, the first program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline. And let me bring some more callers on. Let's go to Michael next. Michael, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I guess I got good timing there. So with regards to those claimed improvements in cognitive function, these case series that you're publishing, you're saying these are, you know, unprecedentedly dramatic improvements, but there's so few patients in these studies, and they are followed up in such an unsystematic way. It's not at all unusual for single Alzheimer's patients or other dementia patients to fluctuate very substantially from one day to the next. And when you're not testing in a systematic way, when we don't have, for instance, consistent numbers on their pre- and post-homocysteine levels and so forth, you know, the fact that one particular patient has this huge swing in their MMSE doesn't tell us anything if you're not doing the whole thing in a systematic fashion. All the data collected before, all the data collected afterwards, and preferably with some blinding and controls.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, there are over 1,000 people on this protocol now. And yes, we have improvements that have not been seen before. And I always say the same thing to people, you know, whoever else is studying this, line up all the people, bring these people to me who've shown improvement. Let's take a look at them and I'll line up the people that we've shown improvements in. I couldn't agree with you more. You have to start somewhere, though. You have to start with the anecdotes and then you go from there. We're now publishing the next 50 people who've done very well. And then we have, as I mentioned earlier, both a trial with Providence Healthcare and a trial with Cleveland Clinic. So these people will have, as just as you said, systematic evaluation before and after.
But could this be largely anecdotal? I mean, is there at this point, because it is a small sampling?
Yeah. So for the, you know, we published just the first 19 patients. But again,
you've published three papers, I believe.
We published four, those 19 were in just two papers.
These are all peer reviewed.
These were all in peer reviewed journals. Yes. The experience is that people who have Alzheimer's disease do not get better. And even those who fluctuate don't stay better for 5.5 years.
Let me ask you about something silly before I go to more calls here. And maybe not silly. I don't know. I've been hearing for years about coconut oil.
Yeah. So, again, if you look at the brain function and you look at the ability to produce mild ketosis, which is what we're after. And in fact, by the way, when you make these ketone bodies, one of them, for example, enters the brain and actually interacts with specific histones and actually increases the production in your brain of what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. So it has a very clear mechanism, at least one, by which it improves cognitive function. And one of the ways to enhance your use of fats is to take some saturated fats, so-called MCTs, or medium-chain triglycerides. Coconut oil happens to make medium-chain triglycerides. It happens to include them. And they're typically around 12 carbons. Some people like to take what's called caprylic acid, which is 8 carbons and actually is absorbed a little bit better. But either of those will help to drive you into ketosis, along with things like fasting and exercise.
In fact, you recommend as part of your protocol fasting for how many hours?
So what we recommend is if you are ApoE4 negative, to fast at night for 12 to 14 hours. And on the other hand, if you're ApoE4 positive, and there's a whole website on this, apoe4.info, with over 2,000 people who are ApoE4 positive and the vast majority on this protocol, then they do 14 to 16 hours of fasting at night.
And how many hours sleep a night?
You hopefully get 8 hours of sleep a night or as close to that as you can, and you should find out if you've got sleep apnea or so-called UARS, upper airway resistance syndrome, which can decrease your sleeping.
Here's Nancy. Nancy, you're on the air. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead.
Great program. Okay, so first I have a comment, and that is that there are certain medical centers that – if you are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, the first thing they do is they pull your license. Yeah. And even though our Social Security lawyer said that that's not the right thing, because just because you're early onset doesn't mean you can't drive. So that's a caution. Second thing is right now we're under open enrollment for Medicare. Do you have any guidance as to... on your website or in the book, the list of the tests and how we determine which healthcare provider will provide the most amount of coverage?
So the good questions. First of all, let's go to the DMV question. And as I mentioned earlier, we just had a person recently who was told that she had Alzheimer's a year ago. And her license was pulled. She went back for her follow-up recently, and she was told that she no longer has Alzheimer's, and her license was returned to her, which is, again, something very uncommon to see. With respect to the book, yes, we have a list of the various tests to get and an explanation for each one, why you would want it, what are the appropriate values, where you want to target, and why you would get this particular test. Now, as far as Medicare, we don't have anything in there about what Medicare will support and what Medicare will not support. And, of course, my hope is that Medicare will, in the long run, support all of these important tests.
Hope with this administration? Sorry, I don't mean to be political, but that's my immediate knee-jerk reaction. Let me thank the caller. I want to go to another caller from Castro Valley. Harry, you're on the air.
Yes, great program. I wonder what the doctor thought or thinks about the A4 program. That's the one with 3,000 people involved I can't think of the name of the drug. And they have just quadrupled the infusion dose and apparently trying to start it earlier and earlier. Do you have any feedback?
Yes. So I know the study well. And here's the problem. Your brain makes the amyloid as part of your innate immune system response. In other words, it is part of your protection against multiple different insults. As I mentioned earlier, things like chronic pathogens, herpes simplex, P. gingivalis, Lyme disease, so-called Borrelia, others, any chronic inflammatory process can engender the production of this amyloid. Also from a reduction in support, vitamin D, things like that, testosterone, pregnenolone, progesterone, thyroid, all of those things, estradiol, on and on. And then, of course, toxins. It actually binds to things like copper quite tightly. So the idea of reducing the amyloid production without reducing what's actually causing it is overly simplistic. It's like firing your CFO so that you can spend too much. It doesn't make sense. Now, I understand going earlier and earlier, yeah, that's because it hasn't worked to go later and later. So although I think the idea, I understand why it was suggested, If you look at the biological mechanisms, it does not make sense. I wouldn't be surprised if it has a short-term effect, but in the long run, you want to reduce the causes of the problem, not simply your brain's response.
And I thank the caller. Part of your protocol recommends a whole thing about oral hygiene, about electric flossing is better and electric toothbrushes are better, just because gets rid of more of that bacteria that's in your mouth and all that stuff that's there?
So as an earlier caller suggested, in fact, the microbiome is important. Tom, I think, mentioned that with respect to Kaiser. So in fact, knowing your gut microbiome, your oral microbiome, and interestingly, your rhinosinusal microbiome, you know, what's going on in your sinuses? These are actually right there. When you look at the brains of patients with Alzheimer's, you find all sorts of pathogens, and many of them are ones that come from the mouth and sinuses and nose. So in fact, your microbiome is important, and chronic inflammation is important. So yes, if you have bad dentition, you're leaking this stuff into your blood no differently than you've got a leaky gut. You want to know about these things because they are all contributors. Each one by itself may not give you the disease, but combining these multiple, and typically we find 10 to 25 different contributors when we look carefully.
This protocol is a whole gestalt. I mean, it's a composite of things, really.
Because that's the way the disease works. It is a disease that responds to multiple contributors, and you need to ferret them out, root them out, find them, and then address them.
Maybe you could just address a quick question because we're running out of time here. But Jennifer wants to know, can you discuss your research and how it may have impact on young onset Parkinson's research or Parkinson's disease in general?
Absolutely. So one of the things we're actually doing is looking at how APOE4 increases risk for Alzheimer's. And as you know, it also increases risk for Parkinson's. So we've now developed a protocol that's very similar to what we call RECODE, reversing cognitive decline, for Alzheimer's. You have to make some changes, no surprise, for Parkinson's, because it involves, for example, the dopaminergic system, not just cholinergic and not just memory, of course. But there are, again, multiple things that contribute to this disease.
And let me add, there's a lot about RECODE in the book. Dale Bredesen, good to have you back with us on Forum. Thank you, and ongoing good luck with the research. Onward and upward.
Thank you so much, Michael, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, and happy holidays to all of you. We're here with you Monday through Friday. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. We'll have some recordings from our archives. I hope you will join us for that, and have a very happy and healthy Thanksgiving. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. Again, Dale Bredesen's book is called The End of Alzheimer's. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.